Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:51 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time, and today is September 29th, and of course it's the last day of the quarter, but it's also the big picture long-term video and audio for the various different asset classes. I thought I would kick off this week with this chart of the cost per genome, which has gone from $100 million in 2001 to $1,000 per sequence of a full human genome by 2015. In fact, it's really rather difficult to find anything that's been updated beyond 2015, not least because companies are a bit reluctant to charge less than $1,000. But we have to also bear in mind that Illumina released its new architecture for its machines back in February, and they anticipate that it will be possible with these new machines to deliver a $100 genome. And that's only within the lifespan of this particular architecture. It's not as if they've stopped working, or that they're no longer trying to chase even cheaper ways of doing things. So within the decade, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility at all that we could anticipate that the entire business model for genetic sequencing will change, and that we will no longer be talking about paying out hundreds or even thousands of dollars for genetic sequencing, but rather that it will be free, and that we will be paying more for the interpretation of the data, because the data is incredibly rich and very difficult to understand from the perspective of a layperson. And that is part of what companies like 23andMe are doing. Or in fact, there's a company in the UK called DNA Fit. It's privately held, but what they do is they take your 23andMe data, they compare it to that of Olympians, and they give you a health plan base, and they can give you a dietary plan, or indeed an exercise regime to best fit your particular set of circumstances. So these are the kinds of service-oriented operations that are likely to evolve as a result of this massive expansion in the kind of things that can be done with technology. And of course, there are both pluses and minuses to that. But what got me back to thinking about the cost of genetic sequencing was Elon Musk's 40-minute, really rather detailed, but very interesting talk that he made to, I can't remember the exact acronym, but it was the 68th anniversary conference for space and a number of other words. But there were a couple of things that he really did ram home. He made a very interesting comparison between the fact that if you wanted to buy a single prop aircraft, it would cost you between $1 and $2 million. If you wanted to rent a 747 to fly you from Los Angeles to Sydney, then and back again, it would cost you $500,000. And the reason that that is cheaper and you can get much more range and usability out of it is because of reusability. And that is something that they've introduced into the rocket system, or the rocket environment, or I guess ecology of this particular sector, that is completely different. It is disruptive. And then the question is that when he begins to talk about the kind of thing that they have in store, what they anticipate building, and the number of technical achievements that they have already been able to really deliver upon, not just a promise, then what this represents is a massive disruption. And it also helps to really pry open this big question about why does it cost such an incredible amount of money to get a new plane out? Why does it cost such an incredible amount of money to develop new products in this sector? And of course, part of the reason for that is some of the same reasons that were hampering the Human Genome Project, that there was this lackadaisical attitude to getting the work done, and that they were suckling on the teat of government largesse, so it was costing an inordinate amount of money. And then there's this expression, or there's a word for this in Ireland. It's called skiving, which is basically you try to make the job last as long as possible because you might have difficulty finding such a cushy number later on. It's often why construction jobs take longer than one might like, and you get it all the time in government contracts. Well, then we have the introduction of Craig Venter into genetic sequencing, and things speed up inordinately. That he beats the Human Genome Project at a fraction of the price, and he set off this cascading effect of the massive acceleration in the development of technology that would reduce the price of genetic sequencing. And perhaps the most important thing about this chart is that Moore's Law, which was the abiding characteristic of the semiconductor system, has been outperformed in an exponential manner. And one has to question whether that is now also possible with space flight, because it is inordinately expensive. When you start to see the numbers that are thrown around, it's rather easy to be rather overcome by just how much money they're talking about. But he's talking about putting a base on the moon for $5 billion. Now, obviously, it's going to cost some money as well to get all the stuff up there, but the International Space Station cost $150 billion, and this is obviously it was the first one, so it cost an enormous amount of money. But what is possible with both the advances that have happened in technology and then also the fact that there is an awful lot of money sloshing around the international system makes these sort of extraordinary things possible. And let me see if I can find this. This is a picture of a nano satellite. We tend to think of satellites as being rather large, whereas what's happening right now is that they can produce satellites that would fit in a handbag and that have got many of the same technical specifications of things that only a decade ago would have been not just multiples the size of, but up to 100 times larger. Companies like Google and Facebook have got plans to blanket the sky in these types of nano satellites. They want to deliver free internet access, or at least availability to internet for the globe. Now, that obviously has geopolitical considerations for countries like China and Russia, which generally tend to be oppressive regimes that want to control everything so that they can maintain their grip on power. And they're not certainly not above interfering in elections in constitutional democracies. We've seen ample evidence of that, both in the USA, in Europe, and in New Zealand. More recently. So then that there are certainly geopolitical consequences to this rapid pace of technological innovation. The fact that that Boeing has got this space plane that keeps beating its own records and for longevity in flight is one of the things that keeps this share continuing to advance. It isn't just that it's building a commercial aircraft, but that it has a significant defense element as well. And the defense sector is likely to be one of the primary beneficiaries of this development of space technology. It isn't simply that we've had an uptick in geopolitical tensions over the last 6 months or 8 months, but that these shares have been rallying for quite a considerable time already. And this is a pretty impressive move. But when we look at, for example, some of the more legacy producers of satellites, then they aren't doing especially well. If your business has relied on getting big pieces of not particularly efficient technology into the low Earth orbit, then with the evolution of not just nano satellites, but the reducing cost of getting payloads into low Earth orbit, it means that the barriers to entry for the sector have virtually disappeared. And That is part of the reason that SES Global has come back so much. Now, it has a yield of 7%, but it has got a lot of work to do to demonstrate that this is a support building phase that isn't that's going to be resolved with an upward break rather than potentially even a terminal decline. So again, this is it's another example of this disruptive influence that we're getting. That there is this massive acceleration in the pace of technological innovation. And there are two ways of thinking about it. I was chatting with my children last night, and they were talking about that they were talking about the difference between Star Wars and Star Trek. But in many respects, whether one is a fan of Star Wars or a fan of Star Trek, it gives you a view as to whether someone is an optimist or a pessimist, because the way that people live, not for if you forget about the story, if you the way that people live in Star Wars is pretty dystopian. That they might have all this technology and magic, but the lives of ordinary people are pretty grim. Whereas it's quite the opposite in Star Trek. That in Star Trek they seem to have solved this problem. And they never really go into any detail as to how that was solved, but that they just assume that the human condition and that we all live together in peace and harmony is has been solved. One of course, the big reasons that we do have this period of civil unrest and a low-level civil unrest, rising tensions within countries and between countries. Is because of the aftermath of the financial crisis. I asked a question in today in a rhetorical question in comment of the day today, whether it was the discovery of America really was the cement that bound together Spain after the marriage of Ferdinand and Isabella. And there is, I think, a logical argument to that the riches that were pouring into Spain were filtering down, and it became the richest country in Europe in a very short period of time, and that gave it this expansionary outlook. And Charles V, who was Ferdinand and Isabella's grandson, became the Holy Roman Emperor and one of the most powerful people ever in Europe. But could that have happened without all the money that came in from America? And would that bonding of two previous city or nation states have held together if they hadn't had this abundance? And one of the reasons that people are ticked off is because we have had this massive expansion of monetary accommodation, but that it has been concentrated in the hands of asset holders and not in the hands of asset buyers. So that has contributed to lower standards of living for significant numbers of people. Then you've had the repercussions of the credit crisis in terms of having to pay back the debt and this fiscal consolidation that was imposed on Europe. So now you're starting to get the rise of nationalism and more populist-oriented parties, but that's more a reaction to the situation such as it is. In an environment where you have abundance, you don't tend to have this inward-looking resignation or covetousness. That one would have when resources are scarce. But when resources are abundant, then and when people have equal access to them, then you don't generally tend to have quite the same problems. And we've seen ample evidence of that over history. There isn't a great deal, there isn't any real need to go into detail. So the big question that should be out there is how do we achieve abundance? And technological innovation is certainly an answer. But what we've seen so far has been that the fruits of that technological innovation have been spread somewhat unevenly. And that is perhaps something that is likely to change. One of the, I think, the biggest threats that we have is that we get a rise in protectionism, that the serial success stories will be contained, or that some degree of competition will be forced into the market. And when we look at, for example, the evolution of the satellite sector and the quantity of data that that is going to create, it's just a further iteration of the point that the real value in today's world is in data. The who owns it, how it can be attained, and how it is manipulated is a foundation for any economy. And that also means that that is where the likelihood is that jobs are going to be created. If we think back over the last decade, that genetic sequencing consultant didn't exist. Social media consultant didn't exist. Zumba trainer didn't exist either, or YouTube personality didn't exist. What that says is that there are two ways to succeed in this world. It is either doing something that you love and being good at it, or becoming highly educated in an in-demand sector. And that's always been the case. But the problem is that for people who are not highly educated or not doing the kinds of things that they're really passionate about, and take a job simply because they need the money and for no other reason, then if you're stacking shelves or you're working in a department store, then the chances are you're going to come under pressure. That when we look at the shares of some of these department stores, then they're not good. And now, for example, Macy's is down from $70 to $20, and I think one would have to be pretty optimistic to identify that there is bottoming activity anytime soon. What is also quite interesting is that if we look at, for example, the FTSE 350, and then we look at it over not just the year to date, but if we look at it over, for example, the last 10 years, and what is the best performing sector? And what is the worst performing sector? Well, I already know what the worst performing sector is, which is why I'm showing it to you. It's the supermarket chains. They have done really incredibly badly because they have come under incredible pressure. And whoops, I have pressed the wrong button now. So when we look at the groups within the FTSE 100, we can see clearly that they have come under the. It is the kinds of companies that are flat-footed, that have no real consideration for the kind of evolution that is occurring in the wider market, and that is something that is likely to remain a significant challenge. So, for example, while forestry and paper over the last decade is up 364%, the food and drug retailers are down 45% over the course of the decade from 2007, which means that they went down and they never recovered. And even within that sector, there is massive variability because there are the companies that have got a lot of property and a declining footfall, and then you have the companies that are wholly online and have increasing sales. So there are still going to be people employed in retail, but whether they're going to be client facing is an entirely different question. And that means that we're going to have this continually evolving workforce. And that means then also that there is going to need to be a persistent advance in educational requirements and the ability of people to move jobs, to pursue their passions, and to become as elastic in terms of their abilities as is required by the evolving economy, because the pace of technological innovation is only picking up. The pace of life is only picking up. And that is likely to persist indefinitely. And when we look then at where are we in terms of the stock market cycle? Well, the S&P 500 is, the reason that I'm focusing on it is because it's got such a consistent trend, and we have the Wall Street leash effect because it is still by far the largest stock market, and it is trending consistently, and it is pulling away from that 2500 point level, and it is just one of an increasingly large number of indices that are breaking up and out of long-term ranges. So, for example, Brazil, and of course this is a nominal price index, and currency adjusted, it is not doing this, but in the nominal price, it is breaking to new highs. The South African index is breaking up to new high ground, and the Thai market has done the same thing, and we've seen the same thing from Taiwan. India did it earlier this year and is now consolidating. And when we look at all of these markets, and we see that the number that are making new all-time highs far outstrips those that are making new lows, then when we hear that we have synchronized global economic expansion, then we know why, that this is still a bullish environment. And part of the reason it's bullish is because the Federal Reserve might be thinking about reducing the size of its balance sheet. But what we do know is that the ECB picked up the baton for increasing monetary stimulus in 2015, which was just after the Fed stopped its quantitative easing program. So that is something that I think is very much worth considering. It isn't so much any longer that it is the Fed that we're relying on for monetary largesse, but rather the ECB. And that policy did accelerate higher earlier on this year. And now we have seen at least some pause in terms of the pace at which it's been advancing. Whereas, when we think about what is it that's going on in Europe, that we have this economic growth which is helping to stoke investor interest in the stock market, and Europe is one of the key regions that is not breaking on the upside. It is still recovering, but I think it is logical to anticipate that if we have monetary stimulus in Europe, and it is the leading central bank that is providing economics and monetary stimulus, that it will have the same effect on asset prices that it did in the USA. And we know what happened there. That with the introduction of QE3, stock prices just went up. And we've had a very moderate pace of consolidation within Europe for the last 3 months, and now it is firming from the region of the trend mean. But it is still considerably below the peaks that we saw back in 2007 and in 2000. So I think that that is a very important characteristic. And I'm trying to pull down the chart so you can see the dates, but it's not holding. Maybe if I maximize it, I might have a better chance. Okay, I don't know why that's not working. Well, Europe then has ample catch-up potential, and of course, Japan is the other market that has not moved to new all-time highs, but it is now trading above 20,000. It hasn't liked it above 20,000 for at any time since the early 1990s. And provided the yen continues to depreciate against the dollar, then the likelihood is that the Japanese market will continue to firm from this region. Now, this is all very positive, that we have stock markets that are in in recovery mode. And what we're also starting to see, for example, is that industrially oriented commodities are on a recovery trajectory. We can't quite say that yet for all commodities. The continuous commodity index, which is unweighted and represents the broad commodity sector, has not yet broken out, but it is firming and it has a higher reaction low in there, and it is certainly not falling. And oil prices, despite the fact that more than any other commodity, they have both supply and technological headwinds, are firming and are steady now in the region of $57. That's all supportive of the view that we are in a period of time where we have this synchronized global economic expansion, and all of this monetary largesse is contributing to this more positive environment. Then we also have the fact that there is the real prospect of tax cuts in the USA, and that should help to benefit the corporate sector. And it's important because a lot of people have been worried about the fact that we have PE ratios that are at really quite high levels. And if we look at US corporate profits, we can also see that we are close to all-time highs, but that the corporate profit chart stopped going up a few years ago. And it hasn't yet broken out to new highs. So despite the fact that stock market has been going up, corporate profits have been largely going sideways, and that is contributing to these higher valuations. If tax cuts work and the earnings saved from paying taxes go directly to the bottom line, then that will improve the PE ratios. That will make the market that bit less expensive, which will justify long positions, which is why we have stock markets in Wall Street in particular breaking on the upside. The Russell 2000, which represents the mid and small caps, has broken emphatically higher in here this week, and part of the reason for that is because it's the smaller companies generally don't have the wherewithal to engage in the tax two-step to move money around so that they don't end up paying any tax on it. But we have to consider that the better the news is, the greater the likelihood is that central banks are going to choke it off, that they're going to conclude that things are good enough that they can start to remove the monetary largesse. And it hasn't happened yet in Europe, and Europe is by far the most important right now because they have doubled the size of their balance sheet and they have literally bought an economic recovery in Europe. They haven't yet been able to conquer unemployment. I think it's also worth considering that unemployment in Europe was pretty high before the recession. So it is also structural, and not least in terms of the rigidity of their labor markets. But it is certainly also a condition or something that the ECB will be aware of, and particularly when they do not have rising inflation. But what we do have in Europe is this funny condition. Because if you look at, for example, the German Bund, it was in negative territory for some time in 2016, and it's currently around 46 basis points. But inflation in Germany is just under 2%, which means that without the ECB buying bonds, Bunds, hand over fist, then the yield would be higher. It would have to be higher in order to compensate bond investors for the loss that they're taking right now on the inflation. So that is a contradiction. This is an incredible contradiction in the market, and it's something that has persisted already for years. And when contradictions like that persist and become normal, then we don't have to look very far for where the next problem is going to be, because those contradictions do not last indefinitely. So what happens in terms of what the Fed is doing are important, but what the ECB does is more important. Because if we get two central banks that were previously major buyers of bonds and contributors to the global liquidity flood, then if they start removing that liquidity, then we are coming to the end of what has been a very impressive liquidity-fueled rally, and it could contribute to a recession. That is something that is really worth keeping an eye on. And I think the other thing that is really worth keeping an eye on are high yield spreads. And high yield spreads are at very low levels. They're close to lows that we really haven't seen since 2014. And after that move in 2014, they went up a lot. They were down at a low of 2.2%, and they went as high as 8.6%, or 8.26%. So 600 basis points, or that's a substantial move in yields. And it's not as if issuance has stopped. The quantity of bonds that is being issued, and not least with covenant or indeed no covenants, then that is something that is a risk. It's a substantial risk in terms of the high yield market, but not really a risk until interest rates start to rise and liquidity starts getting choked off. So then it's likely to be a lead indicator for the wider market. And right now it is looking very benign. So that also is suggestive of that if we think about where are we in the cycle, well, we're certainly in the acceptance stage. We haven't had a blow off in terms of stock valuations. It's arguable to a certain extent that they are not cheap, but they're not ridiculously expensive. And in a bubble, things do get ridiculously expensive. And I think that there is the possibility that we could have a bubble develop in stock markets, but probably not yet. I think the much more likely scenario is that when we do eventually get a bubble in stock markets, we could be 10 years away from it. The more likely scenario, I think, is that when interest rates move up and when the ECB exits its quantitative easing program, we'll have a recession. And that recession will be difficult for highly leveraged people, but it's probably not going to contribute to the crash kind of scenario that we had in 2000 and 2007. What it could do is bring some of the major indices back to test the upper side of their underlying ranges. And for indices like the S&P 500, that could be a really quite considerable drop. But then, because we have this technological innovation, and because that would squeeze some of the leverage out of the market, then we would have some, I think, really quite profound changes, because we would have different political structures. That is also when the risk would come through of protectionism. So those are the risks that would be associated with the next recession. But longer term, people are still not that heavily invested. Really haven't met anybody who is giving up their day job because they're making so much money out of the FANG shares that they don't have to work anymore. And I believe that that is something that will eventually occur. We will have people starting to give up on everything and going off and buying these technology shares. Right now, what people are really interested in is Bitcoin. And that is something that has been doing spectacularly well. And there is a big question about whether it is a bubble, and I would think that it is almost certainly a bubble. But then we have to caveat that with where in the bubble. Is it the bubble 2 weeks before it pops? I don't believe that it is. I think as long as it is having these sharp pullbacks and equally sharp rebounds, then that's the hallmark characteristic or consistency characteristic of this trend. And I think it is also worth looking at it on a log scale basis. Because if we look at it on a log scale basis, then what we're getting are much more consistent steps. That rather than looking at it on an absolute basis, if we look at it on an un as the same way that an unleveraged investor would look at it, then what we have is a staircase step sequence uptrend. And as long as it's doing that, it's a trend in motion. And if it's consistent and a consistent trend is a trend in motion, then the likelihood is that it will take out the $5,000 level and that it could go up considerably beyond that, and that in future 5,000 would be the next area of potential support. So that's what we could expect in terms of the consistency of the trend. Of course, there is the possibility that it turns out not to be any consistent any longer, and what that would represent is a sustained move below 3,000. And unfortunately, that band 3 to 5,000 is considerable. It's 66% from trough to peak. We don't get to tell the market what to do, and that is something that we have to really try and foster, is the humility to allow the market to unfold as it's going to, because it does not listen to us. And this is just simply the consistency of this particular trend. And if the volatility is too much, then one really should not be participating in it. What is also evolving is the derivatives market in this, and that we are on the cusp of getting options on some of these cryptocurrencies, and that is going to introduce leverage into a market which has been primarily influenced by absolute or well, no leverage, or just retail investors. That is that could be a profound change for this kind of market. And even then, Bitcoin is only worth in the region of about $150 billion. It has the potential to get considerably larger, and eventually it will have its denouement. But there isn't a great deal of evidence that we have reached that point just yet. And I think the biggest risk is from governments, because the bigger it gets, the greater the likelihood is that it is going to be attacked by governments. When we think about what's likely to happen in terms of the inflation, then I think that the way we measure inflation is largely broken. And because what I can see is the cost of living rising, but by and large, wages have been largely static, and that is not being reflected in the inflation measures. Generally speaking, inflation tends to strip out the energy and food costs, but in the last decade, during a commodity boom where they trended rather than being highly cyclical, then they didn't count the inflation. And inflation was underreported. Now, when we look at US Treasuries, they have been going sideways since 2011. And now we're testing the progression of lower rally highs from early this year. A sustained move above 2.4% would begin to suggest that we're getting more than short-term return to demand to supply dominance. And if you look out to the somewhat shorter end of the curve, around 2 years, then yields are rising. And this looks like a consistent trend. And they're breaking on the upside. So they're beginning to price in the next interest rate hike, or the potential for an interest rate hike in December. And that will take it to close to where the Fed funds rate is, but the bond market is unwilling to bet that there is going to be more interest rate hikes. And part of the reason for that is because they're worried about deflation, and the fact that the central bank is saying quite clearly they don't understand why we don't have any inflation is not particularly comforting. So they're raising rates and they're reducing the size of the balance sheet because they're anticipating inflation, but also because of the size of the balance sheet and the fact that there are over $400 billion worth of bonds need to be refinanced in 2018. And we simply do not know what removing that quantity of money from the global system is going to contribute to. Because the only example we have was Europe. They took €1 trillion out of circulation within the space of about 2.5 years and created a deflationary environment. And part of the reason that they had to add back in over €2 trillion was because of the repercussions of that balance sheet reduction. So what the Fed does is going to be, I think, very, very important. And how the market reacts to it is, I think, something that we have to pay particular attention to. It's why we have to bear, I think, pay very close attention to the yield curve, pay close attention to high yield spreads, the leading indicators, but then also to the consumer staples. Because consumer staples did phenomenally well from the move up from 2009 and trended really very consistently higher. But now they are below the trend mean, and this is not the first time. So, but what they have done every other time is bounce and bounce pretty emphatically. And when they bounced, they moved on to a new high. So we're now at around this 550 point level. And it is interesting to look at what exactly is in the index, because it is consumer type companies, it's supermarkets, it's the cigarette companies, and it is beer and drinks and those types of companies. So it is a very, very broad-based index. And it is worth considering that if it is rolling over, then obviously it isn't going to be everything is rolling over. But if enough of the shares within it are rolling over, then because it was such an impressive performer and one of the early leaders, then it could also be a lead indicator for trouble later. That's why it's important to keep an eye on these kinds of indices that were early leaders, because the leadership is in our parlance a temporal designation, that it gives us a timing indicator that if they are among the first and the best relative performers off the low and they remain in uptrends, then the strong likelihood is that they are going to peak first. And when we think about the number of people that are employed in some of these large retailers, then it's not difficult to imagine where the problems might be, because recessions are almost always preceded by an uptick in unemployment. And eventually, we are going to see some of these malls, some of these big box retailers, particularly those that are in the middle, the ones that are appealing to the really low cost people are the low cost segment of the market are doing fine. Ross Stores, for example, has rallied back in emphatic fashion because it is appealing to the very low end of the market. Then Amazon is much more oriented towards the higher value end of the market, and it continues to consolidate here below the mostly below the $1,000 area. But we've already looked at Macy's, and that represents the middle. The middle is being hollowed out, and there is this polarization coming in between the winners and the losers. So what that is going to contribute to is an uptick in people that are out of work. And it is a very big question whether uneducated labor type work is going to be able to get back into employment, that it might be dependent on labor mobility. So I think that that's an important question. And it's why I'm paying particular attention to the consumer goods companies, because as long as they're trending higher, I can't see that there's going to be any real problem. But if they roll over, it could be a lead indicator. Because the important thing to realize about cyclical shares, and I believe that the banks and the resources and the biotechnology shares are cyclical. They tend to be late stage catch up plays that will peak after the wider market. So they're going to be among the better performers in the final stages of a bull market, and they are moving to positions of outperformance. And so that is very much in line with the hypothesis that if you have banks breaking on the upside, then and you have the biotechnology sector and the mining sector all doing pretty well, then what they are representative of are the kinds of cyclical companies that get these lumpy cash flows and generally tend to do very well in a period of synchronized global economic expansion. But we know what follows periods of synchronized global economic expansion, and it is periods when the globe is not expanding synchronously. And that means there's going to be a recession somewhere. So I think that that's a very important thing to bear in mind, because we're still in a very benign environment. And as long as we remain in the benign environment, we give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But that doesn't mean that we ignore what are potentially topping characteristics. We have to be increasingly alert to what they might look like, despite the fact that we are still fully invested, that because there is no evidence just yet that we are in a toppy environment, rather that we know that we're late in the stage. But that doesn't mean that prices stop going up. In fact, what it also means is that the cyclical sector could do phenomenally well in this kind of environment. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.